we're back after, I mean, you guys have been getting episodes from us, but we haven't recorded since
forever.
May.
Yes.
And it's now September. So we took our little summer hiatus.
You had some good things happen over the summer, right?
You know, got married, finished a book.
None too shabby, you know, small things.
Small things. So therefore we weren't recording. But we're so glad to be back with another episode of For the Medical Record. This is one of our mini episodes where we interview someone who presented in the colloquia series here at Hopkins.
Yes. And today we had the privilege, the honor of conversing with Dr. Joseph Leonardo Vignone. Dr. Vignone is an assistant professor of history at Gonzaga University.
And today we'll be talking to him about one chapter in particular, but the entire project of his monograph in progress called Remembering Bodies, A Medieval Islamic History of Human Enhancement.
Peace.
Okay, so I'll go ahead and get started with the first question then. Would you mind summarizing the paper that you presented at the colloquium, its main points, what you were trying to get across, et cetera?
Yeah, the chapter that I presented at the colloquium dealt with medieval Islamic medical compendia and the arc of that kind of medical writing in the medieval Islamic era, by which I mean from the 9th to 12th century CE. And as I said, in this era, physicians are collecting therapeutic, prognostic, diagnostic material on basically diseases that affect the body from head to toe. And I focused in this chapter on those parts of those compendias that dealt with diseases of the head and of the brain, and in particular, diseases affecting the faculty of memory, as well as cognition and understanding, and how those physicians understood those diseases to arise from specific humoral conditions of the organ of the brain, and how you could resolve those humoral conditions with medicines, and in particular, as time goes on, whether or not you could apply those same kind of therapies to resolving everyday forgetfulness so as to help an individual memorize and retain information for scholarly ends.
Nice. Thank you. And I really did enjoy that part of the dialogue where you were describing different parts of the brain, its function, and how it was being used or pathologized during the time period in which you're researching.
The idea that the thing that you were trying to recall was in the back of your brain and you just had to move it up to your front in order to remember it. I thought that was such a cool way of thinking about memory.
And not to forget chewing gum.
Yes.
Chewing gum, yeah.
gum helping memory. I love that. All of it made total sense to me. I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
There's certainly a continuity of not only the metaphors that we use for recollection and retention of memories, but also a sort of scholarly idiom that we continue to use today. It's an interesting continuity with these medieval scholars that I've been studying.
Speaking of that scholarly idiom, can you please share with us, you know, what led you to studying this topic because it's so unique, and how did you come to writing this paper? You know, who are some of your interlocutors, the folks you're in conversation with? Very interested in those questions.
Yeah, so I started this project in a seminar as a graduate student. We were reading texts of scholarly formation. This is called adab, which literally means etiquette. And this is a genre that comes into its own during the 10th century, where the Islamic scholarly elite, which is emerging as a class in the cities of North Africa, Middle East, and Central Asia, begin to discuss their own formation as scholars. So what does it mean to be scholars? And what are the etiquettes, the bodies of knowledge, the ethics that you need to cultivate in order to be a scholar? And as I was reading through these texts, I noticed there was a lot of material about diet, and even substances that scholars are supposed to regularly use to maintain a scholarly sort of schedule and lifestyle. And I was curious as to where this medicine came from. And so that led me to contemporaneous works of medicine by luminaries, including Ibn Sina, Abu Bakr Razi, and Al-Majusi. And I found that there was a more or less direct correspondence between the medicines that these scholars would use, or those physicians would use, to resolve periods of, you know, forgetfulness or lethargy. There was a direct correspondence between the treatments for those diseases, those formal pathologies, and what the scholars were writing about in their treatises of etiquette. And I found that there is a long-standing and enthusiastic engagement on the part of those scholars with medicine for use in their own scholarly lives, which is to say, not to resolve pathologies per se, but to pursue this ongoing regimen of enhancement to anticipate, but also obviate episodes of forgetfulness, which may come about, you know, due to anything happening in your scholarly life, be it, you know, poor sleep or misadventure or diseases, especially those later in life as part of senescence.
So interesting. So this chapter that you presented to us as part of the colloquium is on theories of mind and memory, and we really enjoyed reading it. But I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how this chapter fits in with the other chapters in this monograph and give us a taste of what some of those other chapters focus on.
This chapter is towards the beginning of the monograph. So this is going to be like a preliminary chapter where I explain the humoral reasoning of that medical literature, the increasing desire on the part of physicians to write for a scholarly audience that they understand are not practitioners, but are invested in medicine. So this sets the stage, as I said, for later chapters where I'll talk about the body of the scholar. So how is the body of the scholar supposed to appear? How is it supposed to be groomed, maintained, and that identity is understood as an embodied identity that's in need of maintenance throughout the life of that scholar.
Thank you so much. On another note, we are curious if anything surprised you in the process of conducting this research, for better or for worse.
It's one of our favorite questions.
Mm-hmm.
There is an unfortunate characterization of the Islamic scholarly elite, especially as one approaches modernity, or I should say early modernity, that Islamic religious scholars had this very contentious relationship with medical reasoning, because it was understood that this medical reasoning was pioneered by precedent non-Muslim societies. So Galen being a Roman physician, Hippocrates being an earlier Greek physician, the idea was that these scholars viewed these individuals' medical knowledge with suspicion because they weren't properly Muslim. And what I found when I went to the sources themselves was, as I said, this enthusiastic engagement with these sources, not an uncritical engagement. So while the Islamic scholars had, you know, a lot of respect for the likes of Hippocrates and Galen, they weren't shy about pointing out shortcomings or inaccuracies. By this, I mean there was this very constructive, respectful, reverential, I would say, relationship with these earlier sources that indicates that the scholars understood themselves in continuity. As we were saying earlier, where we felt that continuity with the scholars of the medieval period, those scholars themselves in the medieval era understood themselves to be in continuity with Galen and with Hippocrates and with other physicians like Charaka in the Indian context. So I was very pleasantly surprised that the earlier secondary scholarship's characterization of Muslim scholars in the medieval period feeling awkward or like their engagement with Galen and Hippocrates and others needed some sort of religious explaining. I was very pleasantly surprised to see that's not reflected in the primary sources that I've engaged with.
Thank you so much. And then this is the question that we ask every historian of medicine that we have onto this podcast, whether as one of these mini episodes relating to the colloquium or as one of our longer episodes. And that is, how do you feel that this historical work can be related or does relate to problems, questions, or debates in healthcare or in medicine today?
The issues that I discuss in this monograph, so natural aptitude, energy levels, mental health, emotional health, spiritual health, the relationship of a educated, erudite body with the medical industry, be that from the perspective of resolving psychiatric illness or deficits of attention, but also more abstractly perceived deficiencies in bodies, which are historically determined, socially determined. I think that documenting this early arc in a similar level of engagement and interest in the medieval period helps us see that these issues are very long-standing, They are literary traditions that engage with them directly and offer compelling answers to ethical dilemmas and other kinds of dilemmas we might experience as we ourselves as scholars narrate what it means to have a body and how that relates to our own processes of learning, what bodies are considered normal or what bodies are considered normalized.
Sweet. Thank you so much. Before you go, so I wanted to ask you this at our happy hour. I was curious, you hinted at substances. So I was wondering if you could say more about how drug use, whether that be so-called illicit drug use or experimental, how these things affect different parts of the brain and our memorization processes. And in the second part, we talked about running. I'm curious if you could talk about ways in which that helps you out mentally, spiritually, and physically, obviously, but or otherwise.
Yeah, so in answer to the first part of the question, in the medieval period, the most famous and even notorious drug for enhancing the memory is called baladr. It's a relative of the cashew. And when these are processed and pressed into a syrup and taken orally, it was thought that because of the very humorally warm nature of this drug in particular, that it was a very potent way of quickening one's thought. So the movement, the actual physical movement of thought through the brain. And I say that this is famous and notorious because we can see from the sources it's very widespread, and the risks associated with it were generally thought to outweigh any possible benefit. So we have no shortage of cautionary tales, not only in scholarly etiquette writing, but in broader literary productions of the medieval Middle East, where students, you know, take too much of the drug and show up to class in a state of undress or in a state that would seem to, you know, ironically signal this body as scholarly, but in a way that is, you know, intemperate or unwise. This idea that you're taking a shortcut to get to knowledge that, you know, is usually won through years of study. And we could see debates, you know, we could see this anticipates debates that we have today about similar substances that are used and the questions that arise about ethics. The questions surrounding these drugs aren't, you know, are they suspicious because they are recommended by non-Muslim physicians? And they're more about, is it ethically right for students to be using these drugs? And is it safe for them to be using it? And that's an interesting anxiety to probe in the medieval literature. And let's see, to connect it to this question, as I often tell junior scholars, to deal with the own stress that I had, you know, completing a dissertation, being on the academic job market, I took to running longer and longer distances. And I felt that this helped put me in my body, as I think a lot of mindfulness advisors talk about. You want to be in your body. You don't want your mind to take you somewhere else, you know, your anxieties to take you off task or something like that. So I was reflecting while I was writing this dissertation, and as I'm writing the monograph and I pursue my own kind of like scholarly regimen of healthcare, or self-care, I should say, I often think about what it means for me to want to be in my body. Especially since, as I do, and many people do, as I'm running, I'm thinking about my work and my scholarship and, you know, where I'm going figuratively while I'm making my body go somewhere literally. It's an interesting way of thinking about, of reflecting on how we think about the relationship of our mind and our bodies and of our intellectual capacities. You know, am I a better scholar because I run? Am I a better scholar because I direct my energy in certain ways? You could see how we, you know, we discipline our own bodies to be scholarly bodies. And obviously that brings up questions about ability and disability, about access and privilege, about exercise as being a conspicuous sort of, you know, middle class pursuit, upper class pursuit. You're considered to be a more responsible person if you do these exercises, if you avoid certain things, certain diets and certain substances in favor of other ones, which are considered more appropriate. You could see how we are constantly connecting scholarly identity to embodied practices in a way that I think are just very resonant with the concerns that were shared by our medieval antecedents.
I have so many more thoughts on that. So many connections there between like substance and diet and ethics as it relates to like your professional self operating within a capitalistic world. There's so much going on there that I think is really interesting. And, you know, I was thinking about Adderall, was thinking about my own running, was thinking about, you know, so often when I'm on like mile four of a run, my partner will get a voice note of me that's like, okay, when I rewrite the third page of this chapter, it's got to say this, this, and this. And I just realized that it has to say this. So I'm sending you a voice note because like when I am in my body in that way, that's the best thinking that I do. Mm-hmm. And I always do it early in the morning because then it starts the day correctly. Although I didn't do it this morning, but
I didn't either. I was
Mondays are hard sometimes.
Yeah.
To be in your body.
Yes, that's full circle right there.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for talking to us. We really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you around at other events, conferences.
Yeah, hope so. And we're very looking forward to the book and, you know, future conversations about your amazing work.